Apple Light in the canyons. That's where I long to be with my free good companions. Just my rifle, pony, and me. Gonna hang.
Stop. Carl, I have to interrupt you. We've got a podcast to record.
Sorry, Clara. Sorry, I have to do these vocal exercises, you know. But you're right. You're right. Let's get on with the show. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. As ever, I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining me again for this week's episode, which is all about the 1959 Western Rio Bravo. The film, of course, starring John Wayne, Dean Martin, and Ricky Nelson, and Angie Dickinson, and directed by Howard Hawks. And joining me for this episode is, you know, a frequent guest, I think it's fair to say, regular on the podcast, Clara Cook. Hi, Clara.
Hi, Carl. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really good, thank you. How are you? How's life? How's podcasting? All that stuff.
Good. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to talking about the film today. It's a interesting film, really good film. So yeah, and I'm also interested in hearing more of your singing, you know, later on.
Well, yeah, stay tuned, listeners. There'll be a Rio Bravo. The singing starts after an hour and 45 minutes. So maybe we'll do the same today. Yeah, this is the first Western, actually, I think, on the podcast that we've covered for a full episode since you and I did Stagecoach, actually, Clara, which that was the first film we looked at on the podcast. And it's funny, because I can't remember if I said it on the podcast before somewhere, but my original idea was to do a podcast just all about Westerns. And then I thought, no, let's make it old movies in general, and we'll just do a ton of Westerns within that. And then it's been like 40-odd episodes or something, we've just done the one. So, yeah, I'm really pleased to be moseying on down to the Old West with you today.
And we're also revisiting John Wayne as well, aren't we? Because he was in Stagecoach too. So now we're seeing him again, just in a different stage of life.
Yeah, almost 20 years later in a different sort of stage of his persona, I suppose. Yeah, so what about Rio Bravo? So before we get on to what we think of the film, what are your sort of memories of seeing this one? Is this one, I think you've watched it before, right? And is it one you've seen a few times over the years or what?
Yeah, it is one that I've seen a few times over the years. I have to say, I do get it mixed up with another one of Howard Hawks' films. I think it's is it El Dorado? No.
Yeah.
Yeah, El Dorado, yeah, which is almost pretty much the same film, just made after Rio Bravo, with also a similar very famous actor or very famous male persona also playing a recovering alcoholic. So when I started watching this, I was like, is Dean Martin in this? I thought it was Robert Mitchum. Because I got the two films confused. But yeah, I saw Rio Bravo. I must have seen it as a kid, I think. You know, on Channel 4, yet again, on Sunday afternoons, they would do a Western sometimes. And this was years and years ago. They don't really show that kind of film on terrestrial television anymore. But yeah, I think I must have watched it as a kid. I don't remember it being so slow, though. it's a very long Western. Yeah. It feels like a very long film now, watching it as an adult. I was like, goodness.
Yeah, definitely. I think, El Dorado is basically a loose remake, isn't it? I think that's like 66 or something. And then Hawks does it again with Rio Lobo in 1970, which, again, is a loose variant on the Rio Bravo thing, which is interesting. Okay, so great film, in my opinion. I think it's definitely one of the greatest Westerns. I've actually always preferred Hawks's Red River with John Wayne and Montgomery Clift, in terms of his Westerns. But I think Red River's like a messier film, because that's got some weird stuff where there's a character played by John Ireland who kind of disappears, who you think is going to be this big figure, but he kind of goes away. Red River's also got this really funny ending where John Wayne becomes this real authoritarian figure, and then he kind of gets told off by a woman, and he kind of does a complete 180 at the end. But anyway, so I think Rio Bravo maybe is technically superior to that. I like what you say, though, and I think it's a good thing, how slow it is. It's a really chilled movie, I think. You know, there's room to develop these characters and things. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so I felt like the film itself wasn't really about the story. It's kind of about the characters and their relationships to each other. And I think a lot of Howard Hawks' films are actually like that. They're about, you know, they have a feisty woman, they have like a little ensemble of men, and it's all about how the men relate to each other and how the men sort of feel about each other and react to the situation that they're in. And actually, the gun battle at the end of Rio Bravo didn't really make much of an impact to me, actually. It was kind of anticlimactic. The impact is the characters' relationships to each other.
I think the first time I ever heard about Rio Bravo, actually, I heard Quentin Tarantino talking about it when he made Jackie Brown. And he said he wanted to do something similar there to what Hawks did with Rio Bravo, which is create what he called like a hangout movie. And how I remember him describing it is as a film you can just drop in on every few years, you know, and it just feels like you're amongst friends. And I think he's kind of onto something, because it does feel that way to me, because it's so amiable, because it's got a very measured pace, because it has stuff in there too that's not exactly integral to the narrative, you know. So, yeah, I agree. I think it's what you're saying. I think a lot of the pleasure is just savouring the camaraderie. And the performances are really good too.
Yeah, I think Dean Martin especially is really, really good as Dude. And I think he really gives quite a clear portrayal of alcoholism and as a recovering alcoholic, basically. Like, it's not like, I don't know, it's not like a tortured performance, you know. It's not like, you know, it's not overly dramatic. There's just these little gestures that he does and these little like looks that he gives, and like, you can kind of almost sort of understand what he's thinking and feeling just by the way he's acting. I don't know, I thought he was really good. That's why I found the singing hard, because it's suddenly like a dude is gone and Dean Martin is here, you know, like entertaining us all with his lovely voice, and I'm like, what? The dude could do this the entire time, like. So I think that's why I struggled with the songs. But yeah, I thought he gave a really good portrayal of somebody who's like in the midst of an alcohol addiction and struggling to kind of regain his sense of self. I thought it was really, really, really well done.
Yeah, and I think his character is important, because that's what provides a lot of the dramatic tension, I think, because, and we'll talk about this a bit more, but in Howard Hawks' world, I think you need to be dependable and somebody who can complete the task at hand. And I feel like we're pretty sure that Chance, the sheriff, has got what it takes. I think Colorado's presented to us as he's kind of green, but he's extremely able and talented. So Dude is the one who really struggles the most, doesn't he, because of his drinking problem. It's quite attentive to his struggles, isn't it? Like, you get these long shots where you see him kind of grappling with his inner demons, I suppose.
Yeah, he does that gesture where he sort of rubs his hand across his chin.
Yeah.
Like he's thinking. But it's almost like an anxious gesture, like a nervous gesture. And also his appearance changes throughout the film. So, you know, I mean, it's funny because when I was watching it, my partner came in and looked at the screen and said, is he wearing any clothes under that jacket? Because he's wearing like a shirt that's buttoned down to his, like unbuttoned to his navel. Yeah, so he's very haphazardly dressed and everyone in the town knows he's a drunk and laughs at him. But by the end of it, he's back in a proper set of clothes and he's functioning better. So yeah, it is a real transformation across the movie.
Yeah, because they call him the Dude and you think he doesn't really look like a dude, you know, and he kind of recuperates his sense of identity, definitely. I wanted to talk a bit more about, and I think we must have talked about this for Stagecoach, but I think there are a couple of different ways of kind of appraising Westerns, really. And just in terms of, as a genre in itself, you know, what I always relish when I watch them, in Westerns generally, and in Rio Bravo specifically, is just a sense, I don't know, that you kind of, when you're watching it, you're entering like a fully furnished world in a weird way. Like, obviously they're tied to a particular region, you know, this the kind of Trans-Mississippi West region, and it's a specific era, the 19th century. But I'm thinking of specifically the way you see them in American films, you know, the visual style, the tropes, and things like that. So, do you know what I mean? And I think Rio Bravo's got a lot of the things you would kind of expect to see.
Yeah, like the swing doors to bars and saloons. You know, the fact that a lot of the villains wear black cowboy hats, or they like wear black hats. Actually, there's lots of different types of hats in this Western. Yeah. I noticed they were all different shapes and sizes, which was fun. You know, they're always drinking hard liquor. There's a lot of drinking of hard liquor, you know, and there's always some sort of barn or outhouse somewhere where someone gets attacked and tied up. Yeah, you're right. I think the thing that struck me about Rio Bravo that I don't see as much in other Westerns was the sort of a little few shots of the outside of town, like the edge of town, which was obviously where the Hispanic community were living. And also, I felt like a lot of the actors, I don't know, I could be wrong, but I felt like the cast was more ethnically diverse in the sense that all these extras, I mean, there was one guy that had a bunch of lines that really didn't look like the standard American Western cowboy, you know, which is like this sort of pale skin, fair skinned actor with like blue eyes or blonde hair or something. So I did felt like a lot of the extras in the background looked like they could come from lots of different ethnic backgrounds. And I mean, that could just be because it was in Technicolor, you know, and actually I'm seeing these kinds of actors in black and white movies all the time, black and white Westerns, but it's not apparent because it's much, you know, it's in black and white. But I felt like the Technicolor really added something to this particular film. Everybody, you know, looked quite different and all their clothes were quite different as well. People were wearing different neckerchiefs and some were wearing quite bright, flashy clothing. Some of people were just dressed in like, you know, brown, I don't know, cow pit hides or whatever.
Yeah, seeing as you mentioned the hats, did you notice John Wayne's hat actually had a hole in it?
Yeah.
it's kind of torn. And apparently that's the hat Wayne had worn in films on and off since Stagecoach. And after Rio Bravo, he kind of retired it because it was getting so beaten up, you know, and he kind of, I think he displayed it in a glass case in his house or something like that, which I thought was interesting. And yeah, seeing as you mentioned ethnicity, what did you make of the figure of Carlos then, who's played by Pedro Gonzalez, because he's an interesting character.
I mean, it's nice that like a Hispanic actor gets the chance to have a decent amount of lines and dialogue and an actual role. I did feel like he was quite a stereotype, though. And I also felt like his wife was more of a stereotype, to be honest.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's better that he's there than he's not there at all. And also, I thought it was nice that he had like a relationship with the sheriff and that he's also running a business. He's obviously a valued member of the society. It seemed like this particular Western was set further towards, like, I guess, the border with Mexico than, say, for instance, I guess there's a lot of Hispanic characters in Stagecoach as well. But, you know, some of the other Westerns, it seems like they've just plunked a whole bunch of white Americans in the middle of a, like, wasteland. Whereas this, it seemed like they actually were incorporating with people more of the local community.
Yeah, and I thought it was good that Carlos, he got to help out as well, didn't he? And he definitely seems like an ethnic stereotype through today's lens. You know, the fact he's so excitable and demonstrative can be a bit cringeworthy. And I was interested to read about this, that Hawks was actually asked about this once by a film scholar, Robin Wood, about whether this amounted to the racism with Carlos and with one or two other characters from his films. And interestingly, Hawks was supposedly angry and a bit hurt to be asked, but Wood also felt that Hawks respected that he'd been brave enough to put the question to him. And what Hawks said was this. He said, "These were performers who came to my films with already developed personas. I helped and encouraged them to develop them further." And Wood felt Hawks had a fair point, that the actors in question never were better in films and never had less demeaning roles than in the films they were in for Hawks. And I don't know, what do you think? I mean, I don't think that excuses everything necessarily, but I do think it is important to consider those things too.
Yeah, I mean, they're working in the framework of the time, aren't they? They're working in the world of the time. It's not necessarily right that the only position available to a Hispanic actor was, you know, the comedy character. But it's better that than they are just random, you know, Mexicans in the background. Or in the case of a lot of Westerns, they're just Indians, Native American Indians falling off horses. You know, and they're faceless. Like in Stagecoach, basically, they were faceless.
Yeah. To go back to the point about location, yeah, I think Rio Bravo was shot at Old Tucson, which is a studio in Arizona. It's been featured in a lot of film and TV Westerns, you know. So I think there is a reason why the locales in old Western films often feel samey. And in many cases, it's because they are literally the same, you know. And but for Rio Bravo, Hawks apparently had a new main street built. And yeah, I think the way it feels to me is it's a film, it goes back to that hangout thing, you know. It features characters who are sketched in really well. They have well-defined, like, set routines. Like, they do these nighttime patrols, don't they? You get a real sense of place. Like, there's that saloon that's basically seems to be run by the Burdettes, you know, or taken over by the Burdettes, for instance. So things like that, it feels like we're dropping in on characters who actually are real in a funny sort of way. Like, almost like dropping on them a week earlier, and they'd still have been there doing their thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, they start the film out with history, you know, so there's an implication. I mean, and it's only a few lines here or there. Like, Howard Hawks isn't actually making the characters explain in great length of, great long speeches or huge amounts of dialogue, or he hasn't got some sort of voiceover where somebody's, a narrator's telling you the history of everybody. It's one or two lines. I mean, Stumpy says to Burdette, the older Burdette, you know, the richer brother, he says some sort of throwaway line about land. And there's this implication that Burdette has just taken this land.
Yeah.
And he's the dominant landowner in the area, but kind of in a greedy way, you know. He's deprived people of nature, basically, and of being free. And that's just one little line. You think, well, Stumpy's got a history there. Stumpy came to this area maybe before everyone else did. Or he's got some sort of history. I mean, there's a reason why Stumpy's, you know, lame, which we don't know. And then there's that history between Dude and Chance. And that's also shown in a few lines. But you know they've known each other for years, and so the idea that there's all this back history that you're not seeing, but that is kind of being referred to sort of subtly, means that these characters have quite a deep relationship. Even the antagonistic relationships have a lot of sort of depth behind them, which I think makes the character seem very real.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you touch on Stumpy's, you know, he's been exploited, or he's the land's been stolen, or whatever. It makes me think of the fact that Rio Bravo is often discussed. I mean, we'll come on to talk about it within Hawks' wider body of work, I think, but it's often discussed as kind of a message movie. And I was wondering, like, are you aware of, like, what people say about it? Or when you watched it, did you feel like the film had a message?
It seems very much like the underdogs fighting against the stronger party. So that was one thing I noticed, was that they really are, they're a ragtag group of underdogs. You know, we have the one who's the drunk, we have the young one who's got sort of a shady job as a gunslinger, and we've also got, you know, the basically Stumpy, who's disabled, and we've got Chance, you know, who's definitely capable at doing his job, but has some problems, you know. And then and then we've got his girlfriend, who has got like a sort of shady background. I think it's that sort of message of like the different people that don't quite fit into an established,
like the ragtag,
established mold. But there's also this idea that, I mean, they are a group, but there's also like they're gonna do this without any help. Like, obviously there's no sign of the US Marshals. and also you know, they kind of refuse help. Well, Chance does. He refuses help from almost everybody. He refuses help from his girlfriend and one of his close friends. And so there's this kind of like sort of pushing back of help in this sort of individualistic like attempt to succeed on your own, which I read goes completely against the ethos of High Noon, where the sheriff is in a similar situation but is quite tortured by what he has to do and is in desperate need of support.
Yeah, so when I said earlier there's kind of two main ways of appraising Westerns, I guess the one I said earlier, so you kind of look at them for what you see in them, the conventions and the visual language of them. And another way is to look at them in terms of the fact that they often reflect or comment on what's going on at the time they were made, as opposed to the time they are set. So, yeah, I'll just fill in some of the backstory then. So, yeah, Rio Bravo, kind of like you've teed up there, but read by many as a riposte to Fred Zinnemann's High Noon, kind of the right-wing answer to the perceived left-wing High Noon, which in a funny sort of way, I guess that's the purest form of film criticism, isn't it? So you see a film you don't like, you make a different film in response. It's kind of an interesting idea. Supposedly, Hawks and Wayne both disliked High Noon, but for slightly different reasons. So, yeah, Hawks felt that Gary Cooper's character in High Noon, the sheriff, is unprofessional for seeking help from amateurs. Whereas for Wayne, I think it was more that he didn't like the liberal outlook that people read into High Noon. Because I think it was a film read by many as like an allegory about blacklisting in light of like the House Un-American Activity Committee hearings. But in other ways, I don't know, it's funny because High Noon's, I mean, we may well do a podcast on High Noon one day, I don't know, but High Noon appeals to, like, also very right-wing. You know, I think it's been a favourite film of several US presidents afterwards, for instance, who've screened it at the White House because they like the fact it's, like, the lone figure going for it, ultimately. But I think for Hawks, what it would have been is what offended him more is the sense that Gary Cooper's character just isn't very good at his job, you know. because I think for Hawks, professionalism and being good at your job is kind of a keynote for the characters in his films. So he wanted to make a film where the sheriff would only count on other professionals. So there's that scene, isn't there, in Rio Bravo, where Wayne tells the character played by Ward Bond that his team just consists of, like, the dude and Stumpy. And, like, Ward Bond, I think he's Wheeler is what he's called. But he says, like, that's all you got? And Wayne says, that's what I got. So I think that's kind of what Hawks was getting at. So I think they refuse help. He doesn't want well-meaning amateurs. He wants kind of, he would rather have flawed professionals than amateurs just drafted in, I think, is the difference.
And that's admirable in a way, because he does make a point. I think there's a line of dialogue where he says something like they'd only get themselves killed. Like, yeah. He doesn't want people to help him who are just going to end up dead. And by that point, when he's saying that, one man has already been killed for intervening. You know, right at the beginning, the man who tries to stop the other Burdette, the younger one, he tries to stop him from, I don't know, pulling his gun or hitting somebody or something, and he's the one that ends up murdered. And then, you know, and then as the film goes on, people who have stepped in or people who have objected to the Burdettes end up dead. So he's got a good point there. You know, he's going to recruit somebody who's not a good gunslinger or isn't an expert in the law or whatever, and who's going to end up just being another casualty. But having said that, he also pushes away other forms of help. Like, he pushes away the sort of emotional support that Feathers, the female character, offers him. He pushes away the sort of affection that Stumpy offers him. You know, and it's not necessarily so overt, but he's pushing away the offer of people helping him to sleep. And like, so I feel like he's a little bit too individualistic at times.
He changes, though, doesn't he? Because he ultimately does accept the help, and Stumpy turns up to help him, and he learns to trust Feathers and stuff like that, I suppose.
Yeah, he does by the end of the film, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. In terms of the whole right-left thing, I don't know, I think it's a bit too simplistic to call Rio Bravo like the right-wing answer to High Noon, because, like I said, I think the allegory in High Noon is a bit less clear than many people seem to think. I just don't think Howard Hawks was somebody who really had a well-developed political philosophy, based on what I've read about him.
I think it's interesting that people often link Westerns to politics or to politicians or to the establishment. And I think it's partly because, obviously, the genre of Western is based on history of one culture, I guess, invading and dominating another culture in the West. You know, there were people living in the Wild West that weren't Westerners before the Westerners arrived. But I think it's this idea, I think, maybe because it's seen as an older genre, you know, a lot of, like, politicians and leaders, like you said, presidents like Westerns, it's seen as a very man's kind of genre. Almost every Western I've watched, with the exception of a few, is a story about people either breaking the rules or, you know, trying to survive in sort of unusual circumstances or, like, trying to instill some sort of order in a lawless situation. I mean, almost all the Westerns I've seen, the people are weird oddballs, or they are flawed characters, or they're just on the fringes of society. So there's a lot of, you know, saloons and drunkenness and saloon girls, and I actually think the whole genre is just subverting the status quo, actually.
And it's, yeah, so it's more interesting than some of the frames people try and fit it into sometimes, perhaps. Yeah, because like what Robin Wood argues, he did one of those I know you'll know about them, Clara, but the great BFI film classics books, the little, you know, like 100 pages, aren't they, on a particular film. He did one on Rio Bravo, and he thinks Rio Bravo is actually more left-wing than High Noon, in the sense that the Burdettes and their empire is kind of an embryonic form of corporate capitalism, he says. And he says there's also something quite democratic almost about the group. You know, yes, they accept Chance as the leader, but it's not like he rules by force. You know, they accept that he's the right person to lead the others, and they're all free to leave whenever they want, you know. So overall, I kind of lean toward what Wood says, but I also think that it's probably a bit limiting to try and fit the film into this frame solely, because it's doing some other things too, isn't it? It's not the only thing we can talk about here.
Yeah, and I think you're right about the whole democratic sort of makeup of the group. I mean, Chance tells people what to do. He's the leader. But they push against him, especially Stumpy. Stumpy rails against Chance all the time, so
yeah.
And Chance doesn't ever, he never uses force against Dude or Stumpy. He doesn't really have a harsh word for Stumpy. He does for Dude, I think, at one point. But that's because Dude is, you know, I think, isn't it when Dude's acting kind of aggressive towards Stumpy and telling him to shut up and stuff? But yeah, he's a, what I would call a gentle and confident commanding leader. But yeah, one who allows his group to express their concerns and discontent.
Yeah, and I think that the theme of like male relationships, male bonding, taking responsibility, I think these are all big themes in the work of Howard Hawks more generally. So I think we could talk about him and then we'll go on to talk about, you know, the Hawksian women, because Feathers is really fascinating too. But yeah, Hawks, I think, generally acknowledged as one of the greatest of all American filmmakers. So I could just reel off the films, you know, and this is not even a full list, but, you know, Only Angels Have Wings, To Have and Have Not, Scarface, Bringing Up Baby, His Girl Friday, The Big Sleep, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, Sergeant York, Red River, and many others too. I mean, pretty impressive list of credits, whichever way you slice it, I think, isn't it, Clara?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I think that there's a lot of common themes in a lot of his films as well. I think just To Have and To Have Not, I mean obviously the actor who plays Stumpy, whose name is...
Walter Brennan.
Walter Brennan. He actually is in To Have or Have Not, and he also plays... He plays a character who's disabled, but he actually plays a character who is actually a drunk himself, like an alcoholic himself. And there's a similar relationship between Humphrey Bogart's character and that character, and Chance and Stumpy in this one. Yeah, I think his films have some similar trends across all of them, which is that I don't think he's massively interested in camera work, which he's more interested in like having the camera follow the characters around rather than having the characters come to the camera. Do you know what I mean? And the camera sort of sometimes is often stationary, just allowing the characters and the actors to interact with each other, which is quite refreshing, actually.
Yeah. Well, he's definitely not like a self-conscious director, is he? He's not somebody, like you say, I think, his style didn't necessarily draw attention to itself. And I've read a quote from him that his sense of what a good director was somebody who doesn't annoy you. So that's probably like the perfect director for somebody, you know, in studio era Hollywood was like a strong delivery system in and of itself. So that he's probably the ideal fit for that kind of filmmaking, I suppose. Yeah. But you do get some sequences here, don't you, that are quite interesting in the sense that, well, I think that first 5 minutes is really interesting. You know, I think that's one of the great sequences in all Westerns, you know. You know what I mean? The wordless sequence that establishes kind of the essentials of what we need to know about the two main characters, doesn't it? And it's got that great shot of, Dean Martin's, you know, we learn he's this alcoholic struggling with temptation. And there's that shot, isn't there, where he's looking up at Wayne from his POV. Where he's kind of led on the ground looking up, and you realise the kind of dynamic there from the way Hawks uses the camera. But generally, I think you're right, he's got a more invisible style.
Yeah, and the scenes where they're walking through the dark in the town.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was like, you know, are they going somewhere? Like, what's going on? And actually, all they're doing is walking just through town. But it's filled with such ominous energy and such foreboding, you know, that they could be attacked at any moment in the dark. And also this whole idea that's just these men standing on porches, you know, openly watching them, who they know have probably been hired to kill them. That's just creepy. And also the sense of the light and dark. A lot of the light comes from inside buildings, and there's a lot of, like, dark streets, and
yeah,
it was good use of that.
And I think you're right, because I think, like we've already kind of maybe hinted at, there's a certain kind of bagginess to the film. So yeah, it's 2 hours, 20 minutes long or something like that. It's got time for a fantastic musical interlude. But there are these periods, aren't there, where you get like a long build-up that's very compelling, I think. Like you mentioned, like the patrols. And then I'm also thinking about a scene where Dude and Chance, they enter that saloon, don't they, looking for the guy who, unbeknownst to them, is up in the rafters, which... Dude realizes when he sees the blood in the cup, you know. So you sometimes get these long build-ups with like quite a brief bit of action at the end, but I felt Hawks did all that really well.
Yeah, and I think that there's a lot in the film that isn't even about, you know, action or even about the storyline to do with Burdette. So it, you know, it's Dude gaining respect for himself again and like sort of renegotiating his relationship with the rest of the people in the town. So there's these shots where people are looking at each other, and actually it's the way they look at each other, their gazes, that is telling everything that you need to know about the scene. And that actually is the first 5 minutes is like that, isn't it? I mean, it's
yeah.
the coin in the spittoon, and you know, dude looking at them, and then looking and seeing Chance there, and Chance actually looking back at him, and it's John Wayne's expression which just sort of says everything. Like, you know, you don't even need any dialogue, you don't even need any explanation, you know exactly what's going on just by the way they're all looking at each other.
Yeah, so in that book I mentioned by Robin Wood, he described Hawks like this. He said, "Hawks may not have originated any genres, but he has produced probably the best work within each genre he has tackled. He may not be an innovator, but neither is he an imitator. The genre in each case is transformed from within by the personality of the artist, his way of looking at and feeling things." He definitely has these strong themes, you know, male bonding. Also notable for the female characters in his films, the so-called Hawksian woman. So I guess in a nutshell, kind of strong, tough women who can more than hold their own in a man's world. So Lauren Bacall in To Have and Have Not would be a great one. Let's say Rosalind Russell in His Girl Friday would be awesome. And here we have Feathers. So yeah, what do you make of Angie Dickinson's character of Feathers here?
So I really liked her, and I've always liked her. Even when I was younger, I liked her. I agree with what you just said. I mean, it's always interesting in Hawks films, the women seem to appear almost out of nowhere, and they're alone when they first appear in the story. And you wonder a little bit, like, how they're going to cope in this world alone. Like, in the sense that, like, I mean, Lauren Bacall's character in To Have and To Have Not, I mean, I wonder if she's safe in that environment. You know, she just sort of pops up like she's been traveling by herself in a time where, you know, it's not necessarily the done thing. And then the same with Feathers. Like, Feathers is navigating this very sort of male-dominated, hostile, like, landscape, basically as a very attractive female gambler. And I was like, yeah, how has Feathers not been assaulted or robbed? Or But they are strong characters. They're quite independent. I liked her. I think the thing that struck me this time that really struck me, that never struck me when I watched it when I was younger, is the age difference between John Wayne and Angie Dickinson. So he's 52 and she's 28. And I don't think I realised that before, just because I was younger and I don't know, I didn't pick up on these things when I was younger. And now being an adult woman, now being like, you know, in my 30s myself, I can actually judge age a bit more, I suppose. And it just felt a little bit awkward to me, I think. But then I suppose that was kind of the case, well, still the case with lots of films nowadays, that you have an older male lead and a younger female romantic interest. But that is a big age difference. You know, I was like, he's old enough to be her father. Almost.
Well, Angie Dickinson is older than Feathers is too, because on the handbill, she's described, you know, the wanted poster that they look at, she's described as around 22. But the actress is a little older, so it's even worse when you say. But, well, I think the debate around the Hawksian woman overall, it's been played out over time, you know, amongst critics and scholars and things. But the debate is there something limiting about his approach to femininity, or is there something liberating about it? Because I think it goes back maybe to something we touched on when we talked about All About Eve. You know, ultimately, these are visions of women created by a man. You know, if we ascribe Hawks as the author of these films, which I would. And as such, it tells us something about him then. So there's a story about Hawks getting Lauren Bacall to Have and Have Not to scream her lungs out at the top of a mountain so that her voice would be deeper and stuff like that. He liked deep voices. He said in an interview somewhere, apparently, that he liked young women who acted like they were older. So there's definitely something idealistic about Feathers, you know, in the way she acts, in the fact that she's so young, she's very tough and she's very knowing. And it's the same with Bacall, I think, in To Have and Have Not. But then, I mean, I think the men in his films can be very idealised too. I mean, like Chance, you know, just a name like John T. Chance, first of all. But he's someone who speaks in these very succinct statements that seem to say everything whilst actually saying very little. You know, he says, I wouldn't want to live on the difference. And these quite little quotes he comes out with. So I don't know. I think it seems like Hawks creates a very distinctive worldview in his films that's quite mythic in some ways. It's got these unwritten codes. And I suppose the way femininity functions within that is part of a broader canvas then.
Yeah, I think also you need to think about all the other films at the time and the women in the other films that were made at the time. And obviously there's a lot to be improved upon in Rio Bravo. Feathers has agency and she has confidence and she's got a considerable number of dialogue and lines and dialogue. She's also not afraid to confront the men in her surroundings or in the story. She's not afraid to stick up for herself. So there's all that sort of stuff, which is great. But there's also like some things that aren't so great, which is that ultimately Chance is the one who sort of makes a decision about her future at the end of the film. And also there are some things like, you know, she throws a flower pot. No one teaches her how to shoot a gun or anything. Like she's still in a female role, which is, I would say, a little bit more subservient than a male role. But compared to other female characters at the time, compared to the character, the wife in High Noon, who is obviously playing a completely different type of character, she's playing a Quaker wife, so she's a completely different kind of character. But, you know, compared to, I'm trying to think of other Westerns, and compared to the women in Stagecoach even, or the women in like The Big Country or in other sort of films of this genre, I would say that Feathers has definitely more freedom. I mean, she's able to actually say to Chance, like, I'm annoyed with you, I'm angry with you, you're accusing me of cheating, but
yep.
I don't have those hidden cards on me. And she's not frightened to ask him to search her, and she's quite outraged about it. I mean, I guess the scene I really didn't like was when she got drunk, and I felt like the men were just watching her get more and more upset while drunk. I felt like she was being shown as slightly hysterical, and that felt a little bit sexist to me. But she's also a character that has more freedom than a lot of other female characters in films at the time. I felt like she really could decide what she wanted and what she didn't want. And she's quite pushy with Chance. Like, Chance doesn't he's interested, but he doesn't want to get involved with her until she really kind of... She comes onto him. She pushes him into it, really.
Yeah, that's what's so interesting about their scenes together, I think, is that I think Wayne's really good at playing it too, but like he doesn't know how to handle her, basically. I'd be very positive about Feathers overall. I agree with a lot of what you said, because I think the thing you hear from some people over time who've been less sympathetic towards Hawks is that these are just de facto men in drag, you know, is what they would say. They'd say that, you know, with their deep voices, with the fact that they just act like men in a lot of ways. But I don't think somebody like Feathers is androgynous. Do you know what I mean? I don't think he effaces her femininity, you know. So, yeah, and I think I'd say the same about some of Hawks' other characters, you know. I think maybe some of his earlier female, like very early female characters, and some of his late ones are a bit different. But many of the ones in the films I mentioned earlier, so someone like Bacall in To Have and Have Not, I think the same basic argument applies, really.
I think he takes the sin away from sex. So obviously Chance and Feathers are, by the end of the film, they're sleeping together. And in To Have and To Have Not, I mean, Lauren Bacall's character is very sexy. She's coming on to Humphrey Bogart, you know, like she obviously wants to sleep with him. But in a way, he doesn't make them sinful characters for that, you know, whereas some of the other characters in films at the time, you know, either they're going to face some sort of fallout for having some sort of sexual desire for a male character, or they are portrayed as sort of needing to be redeemed. And like, Feathers does not need to be redeemed. It's fine for her to sleep with Chance and to stay in town as his girlfriend. And I don't feel like Howard Hawks is condemning her for that, or any of the other characters are condemning her for that. It's not like in Stagecoach where they drive that woman out of town, you know?
Yeah,
which is shown as wrong, but still.
I think the final scene with Feathers that we see, I think they wanted some kind of more suggestive scenario, but they couldn't get it past the censors, I think, is what I've read. Angie Dickinson, she actually talked about the attraction between her and John Wayne. She said, "In another world, on the right island, yes, we would have ended up together. Did I find him sexy? More romantic than sexy. The sort of man you fell in love with rather than fall into bed with." So I think I can see that. I think you're right, there is a big age difference, and that's more striking from today's perspective too, I think. But yeah, another thing that's interesting with Hawks is that if you look at a lot of the other directors in that era, he's not that interested in marriage, really. You know, the men and the women get together at the end of the films, yeah, but it's very rarely in matrimony. Instead, they go through this process by which they like learn to trust and love each other, but the relationship is kind of still ahead, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so I read something on the internet saying that it's implied that Chance is going to marry Feathers because he wants her to remove the stockings, and he doesn't want her to dress up in a sexy outfit for everybody at the hotel or the saloon. And so it's implied, and he sort of says, like, you know, I only want to see you in them myself or whatever. So it's implied that he's going to marry her. I never got that watching it. I didn't think he was going to marry her. I just thought that they were going to exclusively date each other.
Yeah.
I just thought that they were going to be partners. I didn't think he was going to marry her. I didn't think any of these men were going to marry women. I mean, I suppose you could have said maybe dude was going to try and marry the woman that he ran after. And
the one he talks about.
Yeah, but I didn't think that any of them were going to settle down and have kids. They just, that did not seem like it was conducive to their lifestyle or something that they wanted. But I think it's definitely true that both Feathers and Chance care about each other a lot, you know, and love each other. But I didn't think they were going to end up in domestic bliss with a bunch of kids and a homestead somewhere.
Yeah, I think we should talk a bit more about John Wayne. Apparently, whereas a bunch of actors were considered to play Dude and Colorado and Feathers, only Wayne was ever considered for John T. Chance, and actually the first Western he'd done in a few years since John Ford's The Searchers. He'd had a few films in between that weren't Westerns and hadn't done particularly well. And Wayne apparently expressed a bit of insecurity about the part to Hawks, along the lines of, you know, Dean Martin's character gets all the real meaty stuff here, so what do I do? How do I play it? And Hawks said to him, so what would happen to you if your best friend had been a drunk and he was trying to come back? Wouldn't you just watch him? And Wayne thought about it, nodded, and said, okay, I know what to do. But it's kind of interesting, isn't it, that he'd have that kind of insecurity or these reservations in that way, though, isn't it?
Well, by that point, he's a big star, and I would assume that he wouldn't want to take a role or do a film where he's not getting the material that perhaps maybe he feels he's owed as a big star. I mean, at that point, he's so famous, he probably can choose the film roles that he does, right? And he wants to do something interesting. And if it's not as meaty for him, then it's just probably not as interesting. And you're going to spend at least a few months filming a film. So you want to be doing something that feels rewarding, I suppose. I mean, I think that he's central to this film. I think he's actually the central point in the film. I think Dude does have more maybe emotional material to work with, but yeah, Chance is the central point of the film that everybody kind of revolves around. So yeah, I think he's a really important character.
Yeah, I think the reason I found that anecdote a little surprising is just because Wayne's so good at it. I think he's actually a very generous performer in this film. He's very good at being a still presence. He's very good at projecting stability by doing very little. That it's kind of funny to imagine him kind of second-guessing himself a little about that. But do you know what I mean? So there are these scenes where he's just watching. Feathers talks a lot more than he does in their scenes together. You know, but it seemed almost watching the film, he's kind of comfortable letting some of the actors have their time in the spotlight too.
It feels very much like, I don't know, like what a sheriff would be like, you know? Like this,
yeah,
this kind of confident, secure, sort of still presence. And actually, in a way, it's a bit strange, but he also reminded me of the Gregory Peck character in The Big Country. Mm. You know, a man who doesn't feel the need to prove himself publicly to people. He sort of deals with his own challenges on his own and sort of deals with his own demons by himself in his own time. But it's this kind of still presence in other people's company. And, you know, he's there, he's dependable, he's reliable. You know, he's a sense of security for everybody, but he's not always emoting or being gregarious or outgoing.
Yeah.
I think John Wayne plays those characters really well, actually.
I do. I think it's one of the great Wayne performances. And I think my absolute favourite Wayne performances are the ones where he goes against the grain of his image a bit, which I think he does in Red River and The Searchers especially, but also in something like The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. I think John Ford harnesses his persona in very clever ways there, but I think he's great here. I think he's kind of edging into his later life persona a little bit at this point. So he's still got some great stuff ahead of him, but he's starting to look a little bit older. He looks a little bit less trim. So go and compare him in The Searchers, which is just like 4 years before or something like that. And you can see he's a little bit more, I don't know, I don't want to say portly, but the waistline's expanding a little bit, I think. And also, there's this element of craftiness coming in. So there's that scene where Dude goes through the front door of the saloon and it's Chance who comes in through the back door. There are just times when he could do so much with so little. Like, I love that scene where he comes downstairs, puts the rifle down, picks her up, takes her upstairs. I think he's great at that kind of stuff. And people would say he's not a great actor. But okay, he's not a great, you know, he's not a great Shakespearean performer or anything like that. But what he could do, I think he could do better than almost anyone. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, I thought that since I saw him in Stagecoach, and I really feel that His facial expressions are really quite subtle. He's what I would describe as natural in the roles. Like, he seems natural. Like he is a sheriff. Or in the case of Stagecoach, like he is a young man who's hell-bent on revenge, you know? And I think some of the best scenes are when he's got some sort of inner dilemma or he's thinking through a decision and he just gets this little frown on his face and I can just tell what he's thinking. Do you know what I mean? I can just feel it. I can feel like that the character is thinking, should I be doing this? What do I do in this situation? And he gets that frown a few times when it comes to Feathers, which I thought was funny. There's a scene in this film where Feathers is talking about her dead husband. She's a widower. Not widower. She's a widow. Getting them mixed up there. And she's talking about her dead husband. She's talking about her past experience, which sounds difficult, you know? He gets this sort of look of sympathy on his face, but it's like this look of sympathetic tenderness. Like, you know, you've really had a hard time. And that completely changes what you think of Chance. You know, from earlier in the conversation where he's, you know, judging her a bit and he's being a little bit hard, just suddenly he's heard the story and you think, oh, Chance is, he's actually got a soft heart, you know? And John Wayne does that with like one line and his face. So.
Yeah, some of his best moments are the things that are the least John Wayne-like, I think. So yeah, some of the moments with Feathers. Also that scene I really like, it's where he ends up kissing Stumpy on the head and running out the room.
Yeah.
But then in something like The Searchers, you know, I think there are scenes where his hatred just burns off the screen, you know, with like the strength of like hot coal or something. I don't know. I think he was a very good performer. I've always liked him a lot. But maybe, I don't know. Let's take a digression because I know Howard Hawks was fond of, you know, breaks, you know, narrative breaks in these films. So maybe we could dig into my or our feelings about Wayne a bit more because I don't know if you saw this, Clara, but a little earlier this year, a few months ago now, but there was kind of a Twitter storm, I guess you'd call it, a controversy about John Wayne, because there was an interview he gave to Playboy in 1971, which started going around again. And it's not new information. Lots of people knew about the interview already, but it was clearly new for a lot of people reading this online. So in the interview, he says some pretty terrible things in the interview, basically. He talks about the treatment of Native Americans. He said there were great numbers of people who needed new land, and the Indians were selfishly trying to keep it for themselves. He talked about racial equality. He said, I believe in white supremacy until the blacks are educated to a point of responsibility. I don't believe in giving authority and positions of leadership and judgment to irresponsible people. So, of course, what happened was that lots of people were reading this on Twitter. Lots of people were very vocal about it. John Wayne is cancelled, all this kind of thing. So it seems like he's kind of an interesting test case, I think, for the question about, I don't know, how do we grapple with the art or the work created by people who that we may regard in other ways as very problematic? What would you say?
I think it depends on what you demand from your artist. I would say in today's society, we demand that our artists be these amazing individuals who don't put a foot wrong, who never say anything wrong, who all have correct and kind and liberal opinions. And I mean, there's many people who work in film and television, or I would say in any art, in all art sectors, who are like that. Definitely, I would say Hollywood attracts liberal personalities. You know, a lot of actors and people who work in acting are fairly liberal or left-wing. However, there are people who have completely different opinions. And I would say not just opinions, but also have prejudices and, you know, maybe they do openly discriminate. I mean, I'm sure that there are directors that haven't hired people because they openly discriminate and stuff like that. But I think it depends on what you want. I mean, do you want the art or do you want the art and the artist as one nice, neat package? And I don't personally care about having the art and the artist as a neat package. I have to say, I'm saying this as a, you know, white woman who hasn't been discriminated. All women have had some sort of discrimination in their lives. Well, I'd say most women have. I mean, but I haven't been discriminated or persecuted because of my ethnic background. So when I watch Westerns, I love Westerns, and I've always liked the Western genre. But watching it now, I have to admit, some of it's kind of uncomfortable because the whole Western genre is based on history in which one group of people were persecuted and impoverished and oppressed, you know? I mean, if you were, like I say, an indigenous American, you know, in today's world, and you were watching Rio Bravo or you were watching Stagecoach, you might feel completely differently about it. You might say, well, this is a piece of art that's glorifying something that was terrible. So looking back on, with all the lenses that we have today, looking back on films made in the past, we're going to find all sorts of problems. I mean, as a feminist, I find all sorts of problems watching films nowadays. I'm like, I loved this film, but actually the female characters here are treated terribly, and this message is horrific in terms of gender equality. The problem is, do you want John Wayne? Do you want the films that John Wayne's in and the films that he's acted in and him to be the same thing? Do you want them to be this neat little package where you can appreciate and love the performer for them as a human being as well as their art? And I mean, the guy who plays Stumpy, Walter Brennan, from what I read about him, was racist, you know, and he was very right wing and probably more right wing even than John Wayne. But, you know, he's one of the only male actors to win 3 Academy Awards. He was a brilliant actor. You know, I loved his performance in To Have and To Have Not and in Rio Bravo. I'm not going to stop watching the films because he was a racist. And also partly because he's dead and he's not going to financially benefit from me watching his films. Boycotting John Wayne. John Wayne's dead now. Like, we're not sending him a moral message by boycotting his films. I guess if an actor's alive today and he does something like this and you choose to boycott his films, then maybe you are sending him a message. But I wonder if you really are. Like, as an audience, I mean, are we really having an impact? And I guess my feeling is that people get too wrapped up in the actor's views or their actions. I mean, unless they're doing something criminal, but I don't really care what John Wayne thought of politics. He wasn't a politician. I didn't expect him to be an expert on politics. I care more about, sounds awful, but I care more about what Trump's going to do because he is president. You know, I care more about what legislators are going to do or what my local MP thinks than what John Wayne thought about politics. Do you know what I mean? I mean, he's an actor. I wanted him to, his job is acting, and that's all I really want him for. If that makes sense.
No, it does make sense. I think I'd agree with like 90% of that. And there's one area I think I might be slightly different in you on, which I'll come on to. But the broad thrust of it, I would go along with. There was a great article about this very subject recently about John Wayne by a guy called Tyler Malone. It's on lithub.com. And I basically agreed, but he put it really well. He said, "It doesn't bother me, my messy relationship with Wayne, filled with love and loathing, disgust and respect, awe and awkwardness, ambivalence and uncertainty, though I find myself increasingly alone in this position. More and more people seem to want their artists to be free of such complications, imperfections and uglinesses." Okay, so I feel much the same way as that. I think it will always be difficult, and it will often prove to be very foolish, actually, to expect artists in any capacity to live blameless lives that perfectly reflect your own worldview. I think it's always going to be the case that massively flawed people can and will create things that are much greater than they are as individuals. But then the opposite is always going to be true, I think. Some of the loveliest people are going to end up making some of the most dull, insipid art too. Does that sound kind of reasonable so far?
Yeah, and I think also there's a lot of focus on the actors. You know, I mean, there's how many people are questioning whether the set designers on Rio Bravo held racist beliefs. And that's the main problem, I think, with acting as a profession is, don't get me wrong, it's a very honourable profession, it's a lot of hard work, but actors are pretending. They are pretending to be something else other than what they are. They aren't writing it, well, very often they're not writing the lines that are being put in their mouths as are written by writers. They're not necessarily directing, well, actually a lot of actors do become directors, but there's also a director, there's a set designer, there's a makeup artist. I mean, there's so many other people involved in making a film. It's interesting that the actors are always the ones that get the most coverage, and that's because they're most visible, but also they're pretending. So the idea that John Wayne actually, you know, held some unsavory beliefs, it doesn't surprise me, because when he's acting as Chance, he's acting, he's pretending to be somebody else, he's pretending to have feelings that he's not actually really feeling, because, you know, so I mean, you could say the same thing about actors who are really wonderful people playing horrible, horrible characters. I mean, you know, Joseph Fiennes, who seems like a very pleasant person, is playing a terrible, terrible character in The Handmaid's Tale. And you're thinking, how can such a nice person, or seems like a nice person, play such a horrific person? It's because they're pretending. you know? So this idea that people, they mix up the personality of the character with the actor, and they're like, why isn't Gillian Anderson like Scully? Because she's not Scully. And you're so focused on the actress that you're ignoring the fact that this is a whole crafted story that's been created by a number of people, not just the actress.
This is the area where you and I disagree on then slightly, I think. So, what I wouldn't say, I don't think we can separate the art from the artist entirely. I just don't think it's possible. I think that when we see a film star in a Hollywood film, they come with a prepackaged image that's been created through the films they've been in, through publicity, through promotion. And I think that image always then signifies something to the audience watching the film. And it goes back to some of what we discussed in All About Eve. So I think in 99% of cases, if you have a big name actor or an actress in the film, the mere fact of their appearance suggests certain things about the characters they're playing. Sometimes it won't work. Sometimes it'll work to an extent. Sometimes it'll be a perfect fit. So I think putting John Wayne in a Western brings certain associations with it. And they will be different to different audience members from different places and backgrounds at different points in time. And it's not just because of what we know of him from his films. It's also because of the things we know from interviews and articles and so on. So the way Malone puts it in that article I quoted is, the idea that one can or should separate the art from the artist pretends that art exists in a vacuum, that what is on the page or screen has nothing to do with the hand that put it there, that the artist's desires and dreams, as well as their prejudices and complexities, don't seep into every word and image. And I basically agree with that. And I think maybe the fact that we've just spent 10 to 15 minutes, I mean, I know I brought it up, but the fact that you're able to have kind of a lengthy discussion on it suggests that John Wayne's image, it does suggest all these different things, doesn't it? Even if you try and pretend that it doesn't.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. But I would say what we're responding to is the most visual stimulus that we're seeing in the film. I mean,
yeah.
I'm not responding to the person who made the hats, for instance, because I don't know who made the hats. But I would say that the danger is that we take these artists and we idolize them and put them on a pedestal. In a way, I suppose that, you know, past people would have worshipped, like, I'm thinking about like the Greek gods or something, you would have worshipped, you know, the god of wine, Dionysus or whatever. Instead of that, mm-hmm. we're now worshipping like the god of Westerns, you know, and so we have this very, very personal relationship with this star, and then the character and the star kind of melded together, and yeah. I don't think we're really seeing the real person, and we're expecting. And so when the real person actually pops up and is messy and human and yeah. says things we don't like or agree with, you know, we're horrified. I mean, I don't think John Wayne was walking into the world and sort of acting as a, you know, he was not the moral authority on everything. And to expect him to be really moralistic and be the moral authority on something. I'm not saying we can't condemn what he says or what he said, but I just think it's interesting that people get more upset about John Wayne on Twitter than they are about
live issues. Yeah.
Yeah, their local legislator who might say something damning, who actually has an effect on their life because he's the one who is their local legislator.
I think we're talking about like stardom, aren't we? It came up in All About Eve, and I don't think there's anything wrong with being a fan of a star. In terms of Wayne, I think everyone's a product of the place and time. And it's incumbent on us in the present to try and understand the past, I would say. I think projecting modern-day awareness onto people from different eras can only take you so far. Now, in the case of Wayne, to be fair, there were lots of people who vocally disagreed with him on a lot of things at the time. But, yeah, art's created by complicated people, you know. And I think, like, a puritanical point of view can be a dangerous thing too, actually. So I think it's entirely possible to find John Wayne's political stances kind of offensive or abhorrent or just disagreeable. I think we should also be kind of wary of making him an ogre. You know, you do read other things about him, like he supported Rock Hudson at a time when Hudson's career was on the rocks, reportedly, because people knew he was homosexual. So you read these things about him that kind of belie the caricature. But anyway, you can really dislike him as a man and still appreciate and cherish his work, I think. Even though I do think what we know about him kind of informs the way we approach it later on. But yeah, ultimately, I guess, if an individual says they don't want to watch John Wayne's films for whatever reason, then fair enough, you know? I mean, I think what bothers me more broadly is the way that the kind of cancel culture or the call-out culture some of the ways that kind of thing operates today kind of bothers me in some respects, I'll be honest.
It is very much centered on visual entertainment. I think if you went back to, if you went on a trip to Florence, for instance, and you're at the Uffizi and you look at a beautiful, beautiful painting painted by Caravaggio, you're not going to walk past it and be like, I don't look at Caravaggio's paintings because apparently Caravaggio stabbed a man to death. Do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, if you go far back enough in any form of art, you will find artists, painters, musicians, you know, writers who didn't do good things. I mean, Charles Dickens had an extramarital affair and then was pretty cruel to his wife. Does that mean I'm never going to read a Charles Dickens novel again? Do you know what I mean? Like, how far do you take it? Now, I'm not saying what John Wayne was saying was right, but he's also not financially benefiting in the current moment, you know? I think it's also Twitter. Twitter likes to jump on the bandwagon as soon as they see something, especially to do with TV or film.
All right, let's go back to just a couple of things from the film then, because we've talked about Chance and Dude and Feathers and Stumpy a little bit. So what about Colorado, played by Ricky Nelson? So, you know, the talented young upstart. I think you see this type of character in a lot of Westerns. He's specifically reminiscent of Montgomery Clift's character in Red River, I think. He shares a mannerism that Hawks told him to do here. It's the thing where he scratches the side of his nose to kind of show that he's thinking, I think is what it is. Most of the performers in this film are really good. I'm not sure if Ricky Nelson's quite on that level. I think he's good enough. I've heard he was coached quite a bit. What did you think of him?
He sort of seemed like he'd just woken up from a nap. In every scene, he just seemed a little bit sleepy, you know? Like, but I mean, he's kind of like, you know, slow and he's kind of like casual, which I think goes well with the character. I liked how he was totally unwilling to get involved initially. And he was just like, nah, this just seems like too much trouble for me. Which felt very much like a teenager. I don't know, like, just had a sort of teenage kind of sloping way of acting. I think he did okay. I think he's there for a very particular purpose. So he's not there to be a complex character. So I didn't really expect anything too complex from him. I did think it was funny how he wasn't remotely interested in Feathers, despite the fact that him and Feathers were much closer in age than her and Chance. There's like no... There's not even a question about him being interested in Feathers, which struck me as kind of strange because I was thinking, well, a 20-something-year-old young man might, you know. But actually, they just seemed like friends, which was kind of refreshing.
Yeah, I think some people have intuited a faint homoerotic attraction between Colorado and Dude. Now, I think it's faint. I don't think it's kind of explicitly necessarily intended, and I don't think it's kind of that visible. I think there's other Hawks films with more blatant homoerotic sequences. I think the sequence that kind of analysis is most founded upon is the sing-song sequence where Dude and Colorado can't take their eyes off each other, basically. It's probably the most criticized sequence in the film, that sing-along, from what I've read and from what I've heard and from what you've suggested to me, Clara. So you didn't like this sing-along, did you?
No. No, I found it really hard to watch. I think partly because suddenly Dude stops being Dude and he becomes Dean Martin, and yep. You know, Colorado stops being Colorado and becomes Ricky Nelson. Like, they completely and utterly shed their characters and they become these two singers. And don't get me wrong, they have wonderful voices. But then every once in a while the camera sort of flashes to Chance, who looks like John Wayne, just standing there smiling, enjoying the singing and being like, yeah, this is great, but I'm not going to try and sing. I mean, and it also felt a bit weird. I was like, they've just talked about how, you know, under pressure they are and how sort of in danger they are. And now they're sitting in the jail cell, having this sing-along. Like, what if people start shooting now while they're in the middle of the song? Are they going to be like, hold on, I just need to finish the Rio Bravo song? Like, it just struck me as really like, I don't know, like it's like from a different movie. I thought it was funny.
I love it. I love it because... Well, it's easy. I know, I get where you're coming from. Totally. Totally do. It's easy to see why somebody would criticise that sequence. I misremembered it, actually. Been a few years since I played Rio Bravo. I watched Rio Bravo. And I remembered that sequence functioning as kind of an intermission, in that I thought it came at about the halfway point. But it's actually much later. It's 1.75 hours into the film. So you have to question in a film this long whether a diversion like that is actually adding anything. And a lot of people would say, no, it's not. I think it's part of a broader tradition. I think a lot of films around this time would take a break for a sing-along. You know, there's a commercial imperative underpinning it, basically. The songs would be released as singles. And yeah, it's distracting, potentially, but you've got these actors who've built up these characters. So then when they break into song, they sound just like Dean Martin and Ricky Nelson. Totally easy to see why somebody, especially watching today, I think, would be taken out in a movie. I think it's useful in one sense, in the... Yeah, Dude in Colorado hardly say two words to each other prior to this. So it serves to establish their bond a bit more, because at the end of the film we see them walking together. I wonder if Hawks was faced with this scenario that he had to have a musical interlude in the movie, and he thought this was the best way to do it in a meaningful way. He wanted a scene where the group was kind of harmonious, where they'd been at odds before. So I think that's probably part of it.
I think it would be better if they were singing about something like that was happening in the movie. I don't know. That might have been even weirder. I don't know. But I felt like the songs completely didn't gel with what was... Like, if they actually sung about, like, I'm a sheriff or this small town or something. But they were singing about, like, I guess they're singing... They're supposed to be singing folk songs, aren't they? They're supposed to be singing, like, local folk songs. That's the idea.
That's the idea. That's actually really interesting that kind of the clash of styles there. So it's quite interesting as a performance that... So Dean Martin croons this song, doesn't he, basically... That gives way to the more kind of upbeat, almost rockabilly-style song Nelson sings. So he does it in a bit more of a contemporary style that reflected his own music. So there's kind of an interesting intergenerational thing there. But also interesting, kind of the flip side of that is the song Dean Martin sings is newly written for the film, as far as I can tell. It actually uses a melody they'd used in Red River, but the words are different. Whereas the song Nelson sings is a traditional folk song. So in some ways, maybe that's an inversion of what you'd expect. But I think this goes back as well to something you said earlier about, yeah, so this is like 40 minutes still to go in the film after this. And I feel like the rest of the film is almost kind of obligatory. The group dynamics have kind of been worked out amongst the men. Feathers and Chance have come to an understanding already by this point, I think. I don't think the later scenes add very much. And Hawks's like interest is not really with the Burdettes. They're important in terms of the narrative function they serve, but his focus is not on them. So yeah, we need the ending, we need the bad guys to be taken out. But that's kind of a foregone conclusion, isn't it? We know it's going to happen. I think that all the really interesting stuff in the film is in the first hour and a half, hour 40, if that makes sense.
Well, yeah, I think once Dude is kind of, how do I say, cured of his, I mean, not cured, but he's doing, you know, better, and sort of kind of getting over his alcoholism, then I sort of feel like, yeah, the story is coming to a natural end. I felt like the end battle, like they were just joking throughout the entire thing. It was like, you know, I mean, they're sort of portrayed as a team, but it's almost like a team building exercise, like they've gone to Go Ape, and, you know, or like, it's like a corporate team building, you know, like they're like, here, you know, like paintballing or something. Like they, I mean, I know there's some risk involved in the sense that people get wounded, but they don't, I mean, bullets are flying at them and missing them completely. So I felt a little bit like they were just joking and laughing, and, you know, Stumpy shows up, and then Chance kind of almost casually sort of like wobbles over to him and sort of says, you need to move away from that wagon because it's filled with dynamite. So, yeah, none of them seem that like under threat or concerned. And I sort of felt like that was kind of to show that they are now a team, you know, they're now a team, they're a functioning team. Yeah, it's not really about the fight at all. I wondered a little bit if Howard Hawks could have got away with a Western, a film that was basically just like four men in a room talking, whether he would have done that. Like, I wonder if some of the action in Westerns that he made was put in there so that he could fulfill some sort of genre requirement. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? If he could have just done a film with a whole bunch of men sitting in a saloon, like chewing the cud, whether he would have just done that.
Yeah, and I think that hits at something. I think this is one of the reasons why I think Rio Bravo, it sounds kind of pretentious, I think, to call it a great work of art, but I think it's a great work of popular art out of a great popular art tradition, which is the Hollywood studio system, which had these commercial imperatives, had these things that had to be in there, had these like opposing forces like censors and the production code and things. But within that, you would still get people like Howard Hawks, who would tick all the boxes, but they'd also do something very meaningful, transgressive in some ways, transformative. Do you know what I mean? So I would kind of place Rio Bravo in that tradition. That's why I would single it out as one of the great American films, I think, even if there are elements that I like less than others, even if it's a little baggy, a bit leisurely, that's why I think it's so great, I think. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think it's great as well because it sort of shows, I guess, the sort of ideas about male friendship at the time.
Yeah.
You know, this, I mean, I guess people today might call it, might say that, you know, these men aren't really talking about their feelings. Although I think they do, actually. I think maybe people today would see it as, you know, these men who can't, I don't know, express their love for each other, because obviously they all love each other. But I actually felt that it was, the relationships between the men were quite sort of tender. Like, in terms of Chance and Stumpy, yep, they really help Dude, but they help him by not, they're not necessarily overt with it, you know? And they're sort of very sympathetic and understanding to him. They sort of say, do you need a drink? You know, you should eat something. You need some rest or whatever. But they're not sort of sitting down and being like, tell me how heartbroken you are, you know? And there's this implication that they did, well, at least Chance warned him about the woman that he was pursuing, and that they argued about it and everything. But so in a way, it makes me, it's almost like a whole bunch of 1950s American men going and having a beer, and kind of everything that they're saying to each other is like unsaid, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think Chance is surprisingly perceptive, isn't he? Like when Stumpy's kind of doing Dude's head in, you know, he's talking so much, and Chance kind of says, look, the reason he's talking so much is because he's worried about you, because he nearly shot you, you know. And it is a surprisingly tender film. It's a tough film in some ways. It's got tough characters, but it's tender, and I think it's really, really good. And as we've already said, Hawks effectively remade it twice. John Carpenter in the 1970s made Assault on Precinct 13, which was heavily inspired by Rio Bravo. Have you seen that film?
Yeah, many years ago, yeah.
Yeah. And I think somebody like Joss Whedon, I've seen a quote from him where he said Avengers Age of Ultron, he was shooting at kind of a Rio Bravo type dynamic too. So yeah, an influential film as well as a great one. Anything else you wanted to say, Clara, before we start to wrap up?
I would say again that the way that Dean Martin played a recovering alcoholic was amazing. Like, I actually felt, my skin was crawling with his discomfort. I felt like when he had sweaty ears and his, you know, scratching of his beard, and I was like, oh God, I can feel the feeling that he feels. Not that I've ever been an alcoholic or had any withdrawal from alcohol, but I could sort of see like just that desperation for a drink, you know, like the sort of shaky feeling. And I was like, wow, he's doing a really good job here. And I never really thought of Dean Martin as an actor, really, to be honest. So.
Well, that's a good point, because I think this comes at a point in time when he was kind of attempting to show he could do more than lighter roles, comic roles. There's a story that Hawks has said to him, you know, if you want this role, come and meet me at 9:30 a.m. or something. And Martin finished a show in Las Vegas the night before at like 1:30 in the morning, flew out and made sure he was there for 9:30 because he wanted the role so much. So I think you're right. And I think also that maybe that goes back to the things we were talking about in conjunction with Wayne, that I think it was known, you know, by audiences that he was a partier, you know, he was a heavy drinker. So again, maybe that kind of factors into the way people perceive his character too. I don't know. All right, Clara. Lovely to talk to you, as ever. Hope it's not too long until we podcast again. But what are you up to? How are things going with The Tales We Tell? Where can people find it? Where can people find you as well online?
So things are going really well with The Tales We Tell. I'm about to release an episode at the beginning of August on visual representations of Elizabeth I. So just for the listeners, The Tales We Tell is a podcast about women and gender in film, television and fiction. You can find it on iTunes and all podcast providers. And you can also find it on Twitter at The Tales Podcast. So, yeah, head over, have a listen, tweet me if you have any comments. And you can also find me on Twitter at Clara Jean MC.
All right. Thanks, Clara. Okay, listeners, find us in all the usual places on Twitter, Movie Palace Pod, on Facebook, on Instagram. That's all for today, but I hope you can join me next time when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace. If you enjoyed this episode of the Movie Palace and you'd like to support the podcast financially, you can buy me a cup of coffee via the Ko-fi website. Go to ko-fi.com/Carl Sweeney. That's ko-fi.com/Carl Sweeney. C-A-R-L-S-W-E-N-E-Y. Thank you.